right, we're the green side of the room.
You're right.
Yeah. Yeah. April sperm.
Good morning. Today is Wednesday, February 9th, 2005. And we are going to have a public hearing on the lottery gambling issue. And I believe we do have a problem of gambling in our state. And the governor is continue to opening up line games. And we need to find out where we are going, why we are doing it. And I think this prudent of this committee having this public hearing on this issue. So with that, I'm going to open an informational meeting. At this time, I'd like to call the Mike McCollum, the Oregon Restaurant Association, and welcome, Mike. And also the Roger Nyquist, yes, lottery retailer. Welcome.
Thank you, Senator Lim, members of the committee. My name is Mike McCollum.
Okay, Mike, and I understand that you are going to leave soon, so I'm giving you a first chance to speak, because I want the audience to know what we are doing him first. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman. I appreciate the courtesy. I had an alterable schedule today. And with me is Roger Nyquist, a longtime member of the association and also a Linn County commissioner. He also has a scheduling issue. I think, what do you have, a land use hearing at 9:30, Roger?
Measure 37 hearing.
Yeah, that ought to be a lot of fun. So he's joined me at the podium as well.
Thank you.
Commissioner Nyquist, I defer to you if you'd like to start.
Mr. Chairman, committee members, thank you for the opportunity. For the record, my name is Roger Nyquist. I live at 3034 North Shore Drive in Albany. I am a Linn County Commissioner as well. I own Lakeshore Lands in Albany. My family's owned it for about 30 years. I'm the only elected official I know of that publicly admits he's a lottery retailer, so I bring kind of a unique perspective to all of this, I hope. I'm going to talk about the trade and economic development issues as I see them in Linn County with the lottery. First, the economic development issues. Linn County receives about $500,000 a year from lottery proceeds for economic development. We fund the Linn County Business Development Center with those monies, have created hundreds of jobs with that revenue, and most recently we were able to entice a company by the name of Signal Holdings to come to Albany and create 200 or 300 jobs. They do cell phone insurance. Seems to be a growing business these days. And what we're finding out in the economic development business as we recruit companies to come back to try to improve our economy is it's as you all probably have heard now, it's a pretty competitive market out there. And companies who come in want it all turnkey. They don't want to spend any money on infrastructure, and a lot of times they don't even want to spend money training their own employees. So these lottery dollars have been, we believe, well spent in our community to enhance the local economy, especially as we attempt to improve the unemployment rate and have things recover. As a trade issue, in Linn County, there are about 65 lottery retailers. They generate $15 million in revenue to the state general funds for their efforts, and they employ about 300 people directly as the result of their offering lottery products. I can tell you that without the lottery, a majority of them would not exist. The lottery has been, video poker has been with us 12 years now. That's become ingrained into the marketplace, and it's just part of their business models. And in the event that were to leave, the marketplace would adjust, and part of that marketplace adjustment would be a lot of them would leave. There has been over time a loss of sales that go to lottery in other areas, and because it's been so long, it's hard to track where those dollars would have gone had they not gone to lottery. And the other part of that is that the gambling genie is out of the bottle, so to speak. And in the event that you're going to have a policy decision to not have the lottery or put artificial barriers around the lottery, folks certainly have ample opportunity to go other places with their gaming and entertainment dollar. Indian casinos, online betting. You can now bet on horse racing on the internet through the luxury of your own home, watching it on your cable system. So, for better or worse, gambling is with us, and I'm here to tell you this morning that at least in Linn County, and for my business personally, it's working, and we're making the best of the market opportunities that exist, and it's a win-win for the state and for local business folks.
Thanks. Any questions? Representative Nelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Nyquist, thank you for being here. Is that $500,000 a typical county bounty? for the county bounty for having
I think we're the seventh largest county, and it's I don't know what the allocation formula is. It's not a fixed number. Some counties, larger counties, get substantially more, and smaller counties get somewhat less than that, I think.
Follow up, Mr. Chair.
Follow up.
Mr. McCallum, thank you for being here. Would you possibly have that information by county, what's in our county bounty from the lottery?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Nelson, I do not, but I can get it for you, and I will.
Thank you.
All right.
Okay, if you could provide each members, I'd appreciate it.
Absolutely.
Okay. Commissioner Nyquist, thank you very much for your presentation. And you talked about the lot of gaining and the economic development and creating jobs. It's a good thing for the county, but at the same time, could you give us some downside that what it's going to cost for the social cost, some of the family breakup and gambling addict? And money supposed to go to the bread and butter. Sometimes they bet the last dollar on this video poker, possibly in the future live games.
Sure.
Can you address some of those things?
I was actually on the, which is now the Governor, Attorney General Kulongowski's Social Impact Subcommittee on the Task Force on Gambling years ago, where we studied the social costs. And because my family has owned a bowling center for 30 years, familiar with what went on with gaming before the lottery. And folks had gambling problems before the lottery came into existence. Folks have had problems since then. And we thought, I was here for the Florida debates when video poker was approved, and the prevailing thought was that we're going to fund the treatment and we're going to at least have an honest conversation. Prior to the lottery, when a family member had a problem, when he lost his paycheck in the back room of a fraternal organization, for example, you couldn't have an honest conversation about that because it was against the law. And now you have the opportunity to at least to have the honest conversation, and hopefully you have the opportunity to access help. I believe, it's my belief, that a gambling addiction is a mental illness, like alcoholism, like other mental illnesses, and we should give it the respect accordingly.
Okay. And the follow-up questions. Do you have a... the hotlines that people can call?
We do.
Okay.
We do, and it's difficult. Getting intervention and getting somebody who has a problem actually into that system is not an easy thing to do, either as a lottery retailer or as somebody at the county who has services for those folks to access.
Representative Buckley, did you have a question?
Yes, yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. Commissioner, do you have any information at all on statistics for problem gambling in your county? Have we seen an increase in problem gambling in the last decade?
I don't by county. I just keep track of the statewide coalition and what they're looking at, and I do watch that and really pay attention to it. And we focus on trying to get people the help when they come and ask for it. It's not an easy thing to do. I mean, I don't know that this is the forum, but I would love to participate in a conversation about how we access treatment and how we get the best out of those treatment dollars that are available for folks.
Okay, just hold on. And concerning the gambling issue, Jeffrey Morada from the Department of Human Services is here to discuss that issue more. So
thank you.
Mr. Chairman,
hold on. This is Representative Dallin. Yes.
Thank you, Chairman. As county commissioner, it seems 10 years ago we had a county commissioner that had a self-proclaimed gambling problem. I think he even left the chair. I think he did. But my question is not statistics. Can you tell me, Mike, what programs are in place in Linn County if you had a gambling addict present himself to Health and Human Services? What would happen to him? What services would be brought to bear on his condition?
The first thing we do is we try to access them and get them involved in Gamblers Anonymous. We do that's an immediate thing. That's as successful as anything that happens. The problem is those are kind of self-governed organizations, and we don't always have control of whether or not the meetings take place and come through. The other thing is we do counseling on-site, if you will, on a regular basis. We schedule time. And if possible, we try to get the folks, if appropriate, into a controlled environment for some period of time. Inpatient treatment.
We were told that... we visited the lottery last week sometime, and we were told that money would be set aside, or additional monies would be set aside for treatment. Do you have a plan for how you're going to use that money in Linn County as a commissioner?
We work with the state, and that plan can, I believe, be further developed, and probably funds could be better leveraged than we currently do that. But again, I don't want to get into much of that detail today. I would want to bring our folks who do that treatment.
Can you let us know what your plan in Linn County is?
Sure.
Thank you.
Representative Nelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Nyquist or Mr. McCallum, how much of that $500,000 county bounty is spent in programs for rehab or turning lives around gamblers?
That's outside the money for treatment. That is purely an economic development, and a small portion of it is for the state, is for the county fair.
A follow-up, Mr. Chair?
Follow-up.
Would you, Mr. McCallum, Mr. Nyquist, would you know how much is set aside for each county
for
the lottery monies for rehabilitation of gamblers?
I don't. And like your budgets, our budgets have been very fluid and changed so much over the last few years that I wouldn't begin to venture to make a guess here.
Okay, if I may.
Mr. McCallum, I think, was going to answer that.
Yes, I know that the Jeffrey Morada, that the person has a full information on this. But if you hold the questions at this time on that particular issue, we will have a full explanation on that. So I'd appreciate it if you hold it at this time. So let's move on to the Mike McCallum at this time.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Again, members of the committee, my name is Mike McCallum. I'm the president and CEO of the Oregon Restaurant Association. We're a trade association that represents hospitality companies all across Oregon. There's about 10,000 food service hospitality companies in Oregon. We have about 3,800 of those that are members of the association. Of those, there's about 2,000 hospitality businesses in Oregon who engage with the Oregon Lottery. We have about 700-800 of those who are members of ORA. Probably that would include as much as 60-70% of the total lottery revenue that's generated. We've been intimately involved with the state lottery since the bills were passed to initiate video lottery back in the early 90s. I think some background helps explain a bit how we got here. And you know, we really are there in a significant way. We've gone from literally a state lottery who did about $100-150 million a year to one who now, in the biennium, we're looking at $1 billion. That right close to $1 billion that will come from the lottery. About $930 million, I think. So we've come a long way in a decade in this arena, and it kind of started because gambling was frankly out of control in some regards in this state. There was a lot of hospitality businesses who were engaged in gaming practices that, you know, were maybe flying under the radar screen of some of the local law enforcement and a coalition of district attorneys around the state, along with then state superintendent of police, Reg Madsen, kind of took it on. And with Attorney General Frommeyer at that time said, we have to clean up what had become a relatively a hotbed for, I don't know how better to say it, just illegal gambling is what had happened. At that time, the state police suspected that there were as many as 9,000 lottery terminals being operated in the back room of various hospitality establishments around this state. And that included, of course, private clubs as well as restaurants and bars. And, I mean, if you walk into them and they didn't know you, those were entertainment-only machines. And if they did know yet, sometimes there was some different arrangements that were made. And that was a system that, frankly, just wasn't doing a lot to benefit the state of Oregon. Hospitality business owners, frankly, were held somewhat hostage by the owners of those machines and the networks that were created around the operations of those machines. We entered into the fray and kind of said, okay, Oregonians clearly like to gamble. Is there a way to do this better? We looked at models from around the country and started the creation of the Video Lottery Network through the Oregon State Lottery that you see today. And I think that's an important piece of information to have when we analyze why we're where we are now. And I think there has been folks like you concerned for years about that gambling activity and its effect on our communities across the board. As this whole thing has developed, we have become very sensitive to some of the issues that the chairman has brought up around societal impacts and community impacts with problem gamblers, as well as, frankly, just issues around discretionary income expenditures. I mean, it's a pretty big deal. If you're a Dairy Queen, you kind of wonder if, in fact, all the money that's spent in gambling now might not buy a few more ice cream cones on occasion. And those are the kind of questions that we talk about in the halls of the ORA on a regular basis. And so I want you to know that there is, I won't say concern, but consideration of what is the right way to proceed down this path. And frankly, we think Oregon has been very responsible in proceeding down this path. As I said, we started for a real reason. It was a very legitimate reason. We started down this path, and we followed down this path very carefully along the way. I've been a member of the Oregon Gambling Treatment Foundation for about the last 5 years, board member of that organization. And we've worked with Mr. Murata, who you'll talk with, as well as his predecessors, to ensure that, in fact, the safety net does exist for people who do have a gambling addiction issue. And we've lobbied here in this building to ensure that funding for that program does get instituted, because it is important. It's important, you know, those are not direct lottery dollars. Those are dollars that you allocate from the amount of turnover the state lottery gives to you. You're the ones who dictate how much money will go to those treatment programs. It's not the Oregon Lottery, and it's not the counties. It is you as a body.
And we've instituted this 1% number that basically says about 1% of proceeds ought to be what's dedicated to treatment. And as the dollars go up, those treatment dollars go up. And each cycle, you look at that number, and it's not ever right on 1%. And it's been, again, one of those budgets that's been played with a bit as we've tried to deal with balancing this over the years. But generally speaking, that's the rule of thumb and the measure that you've put forth as that safety net. Its adequacy is all over the board in terms of, is it enough? Is it too much? Can we use that many dollars effectively? I think the treatment programs have progressed now to kind of, won't say match the funding available, but I think to maximize the effectiveness of the funding that's available. Mr. Murad has done a great job in terms of working with the Oregon State Lottery, who works with the hospitality businesses to ensure that the message of addiction and problem gambling is spread through the retail establishments. And so I think, is it a perfect system? No. But it's come about in a responsible manner, and it's been done very thoughtfully by a whole lot of people through the years. When we look at the administrators, the directors over at the Oregon State Lottery, we've had, I think, five of them in the last 13 years as we've adopted video lottery. We've had any number of different commissioners, okay, very thoughtful people, each of them, who have analyzed these issues very carefully as they've gone forward. Mr. Nyquist, Commissioner Nyquist, alluded to a task force run by then Attorney General, now Governor Kulongoski, who looked at these social impacts as well as things like the expansion of gambling, took into consideration the proliferation of casinos that occurs in Oregon, balanced all that and says, well, it's here. Are we doing the best we can with the fact that it is here? And I think, again, I would just tell you that the debates occur in virtually every policy setting arena, whether they be in the halls of the Restaurant Association, the commission meetings at the Oregon State Lottery, the Gambling Addiction Treatment Foundation, the Oregon State Legislature. It's been a thoughtful process that has gotten us to this point. And frankly, is it perfect? No. Can we always improve it? You bet. But it hasn't happened without a lot of careful consideration from a whole lot of parties. Thank you.
Thank you, Mike. Any questions? Representative Nelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. McCollum and Mr. Nyquist, I personally want to recognize the way in which y'all conduct your business. And I think you've been very responsible, like Spirit Mountain in my district. I think the majority of your retailers have been givers, given back to the community, and we have so many benefits. And I agree, there's always in any endeavor, it's either the person that overeats, and can we be responsible for that individual? I mean, are we responsible for the person who overeats, in society we do have those ills, and I thank you for working coordinately as well as Spirit Mountain, but I appreciate what you've contributed to our economy and to our communities.
Thank you, Representative Nelson.
Okay. Representative Riley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Nelson mentioned, it's easy to tell sometimes when someone drinks too much and they get cut off by the bartender and told no more, go home. Does that ever happen with the at the video machines?
Chairman Lim, Representative Riley, I'll tell you that hospitality business owners aren't successful unless they care about their customers. And when they see issues that they have concern about, they talk about them. That's how bartenders have been since the beginning of time. Mm-hmm. They have been everything from, marriage counselor to employment counselor to about any other thing that comes along. They'll talk with their customers because, frankly, they do care. And, I could name you specific instances where I know hospitality owners have gone out of their way to, in fact, call that question to the attention, maybe not just of the individual, but also to their family, and try to, in fact, head off what could be a real problem. I know that occurs. I know that occurs regularly around this state. Does it occur in every instance that it should? Possibly not. Probably not. At the same time, the responsible hospitality community owners treat it that way. They have the resources through the Oregon State Lottery to appropriately know how to intervene, and we work more and more every day to ensure that retailers understand the proper way to approach those issues moving forward, because it is a little different than taking a drink away. It is a little different.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Representative Buckley.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. McCall, I'll throw you a softball. You mentioned that no system is perfect. If you had one thing to change from our imperfect system, what would your recommendation be?
Chairman Lim, Representative Buckley, I think we can make more of an impact, perhaps on the community-related issues you're here kind of feels like to discuss today, if in fact we can develop more of a sense of real partnership between retailers and the state of Oregon. And frankly, we had that going for a lot of years. We've kind of lost it in the last 3 or 4 years. There's been really unsubstantiated and vitriolic attacks against that lottery retailer network from avenues that are underinformed and frankly just misinformed. Those attacks disregard the facts that, again, 5 different directors, a bunch of democratically appointed commissioners have dealt with over the years. They just kind of wipe those facts aside and make blanket statements that really offend lottery retailers, and frankly it takes away their ability to feel like they need to continue to work harder to improve this system. And I think that's a real problem, because the Oregon State Lottery and Jeff Murata can put together good, solid programs, but the people who are on the ground is exactly the people Representative Riley referred to. It's the folks who dissect with those people every day that have to be the folks who make a difference. And when, in fact, we have an irrational, frankly, relationship going in that fashion, we're not going to maximize the effectiveness of our other systems. Unfortunately, that's in place today. That's the one thing I'd change.
Thank you.
Representative Riley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. How would you go about that? What can we do to make that happen?
Chairman Lim, Representative Riley, I think we're going to get there. I think that the litigation that's been filed against the Oregon State Lottery will lose in court because it's unfounded. And as that goes by the wayside and we work through this issue of, you know, compensation rates on additional products and all the rest, and I'm confident we'll work through that stuff. We've been working through it for 13 years. I think it'll happen again. As that gets behind us, and frankly we have the ability to nurture the relationship between the treatment community, the state lottery, and the retailers, I think we can get beyond it. I'm absolutely committed to making that happen. I know Director Penn and Jeff Murata have a high degree of interest in making that happen as well. So I think we'll get there.
Thank you.
Okay, okay, since Mike, you are here, I just want to have a question concerning the Oregon Constitution states clearly the proceed has to the maximum benefit for the state. And considering that, and what do you think from your point of view, what is the balanced cut for the rational? I'm sure some 25%, some believe 15%, some believe is restaurant associations should be a bigger. What is your the opinions on that?
Chairman Lim, members of the committee, this is a hot issue. There's no doubt of it. I'll tell you that I believe that we have created a system of compensation today over the last 13 years that absolutely maximizes revenue to this state. I think there's no doubt of it. When we look at Oregon's performance as a state in terms of total dollars contributed to the state fund from lotteries, specifically video lottery, you know, we're second, only surpassed by, I can't remember exactly which state it is. Bill, what is it? West Virginia, where they have a couple of huge casinos that the operation runs. And but other than that, we are returning more dollars than any other state to the state fund. The other thing that's proof positive of that is the per terminal revenue that's generated, again, to the state in comparison to any other state in the nation. We contribute the most on a per terminal basis. I think we've created a system that both encourages lottery retailers to offer and then promote the product. And, you know, every time they do that, it's about a 2.5 to 1 return to the state. And so if you don't have a system that encourages them to do that, they're not going to as much, and you will not be maximizing that return. That's why we've had, I think, 3 different governor-appointed special committees evaluate this commission rate. That's been people like economist Bill Connerly and as well as former state legislators like ex-Senator Newbury out of Southern Oregon, really folks who thoughtfully looked at this from an outside perspective, then the Lottery Commission. In addition to that, you take the, I think it's about 22 different lottery commissioners who've studied this over the last 10 years, as well as the 5 directors. Man, there's been a lot of thought gone into your question, Chairman Lim, and I believe that that thought has led to what is one of the most successful lotteries in the nation and one of the most successful public-private partnerships in the history of the state.
All right. I'd like to, while you are on, I'd like to throw one more question. These are some issue concerns, the dominant issue. The dominant issue considered instead of 50% is 60% at this time. And could you explain on that issue?
Chairman Lim, I'll try. It's a difficult one.
I know.
There's a section in the Oregon Constitution that talks about the prohibition of private casinos in Oregon. And then the on-point question that Chairman Lim asks is, if an establishment doesn't do more revenue in other products than he does in gambling, should he or not be allowed to participate in lottery? Because might he not be designated a casino? Well, one of the issues is we don't have a definition of a casino anywhere. And so it's kind of hard to say that a place that sells sandwiches, beer and wine, T-shirts, maybe some, you know, miscellaneous goods, smokes or something like that, that place, along with 5 or 6 machines, can that really be a casino? You know, it doesn't look, feel, taste, or smell like a casino, but, you know, under that definition, there's the question. What is the dominant use of the establishment? You know, this is difficult when put in the context of creating a system that maximizes revenue to the state. It's not a mystery that the places that these delicatessens that have developed over the years, they return a lot of money to the state. Should you have a regulatory system that precludes them from operating? If you do so, are you maximizing returns to the state? I mean, there's a constitutional balance at play there. And I think that's what the Lottery Commission grapples with each year. I think as we adopt different products, that question is going to continue to come up. I believe it will have to be revisited in the next year.
Okay. Thank you very much. And
one question.
Representative Dallum.
Thank you, Chairman. Thanks, Mike, for the explanation. I don't think there's any, I better speak for myself. We see the value of the lottery. We see the amount of money it's made. And in my county, some of the retailers depend on it keeps them afloat. And our county isn't exactly the economic paragon of virtue in the state. So that's not the problem. But I have the advantage this time of having a county commissioner here. And one of the things that we're talking about, the original discussion was about Oregonians for Gambling Awareness and getting at providing service. And with Roger here, my question is straight and direct. We got 1% allocated to identifying problem gamblers. The question is it enough, and are the programs getting there? I have no qualms about any of the other positions. The position is one of the detriments of relying on government, and we do, and we will, and it's not going anywhere, but are we doing enough for the problem gambler at the county level? And it seems to me that's where service hits the ground. As a former bartender years ago, I understand your position exactly, but there are people, what programs do we have in place? Have we got enough money? And are we getting services on the ground? That's my question.
The answer to your question is we can do better. Not all of the 1% gets to the county, and in some counties they probably don't need all of the 1%. Ideally, in the state, every person who had a problem, who needed the opportunity to go to a controlled environment for some period of time to reset their life, if you will, would get that opportunity. Jeff can speak to this much better than I can, but I don't think as a state we're there today. And we do need to go through in finite detail of how the system is working or not working. And I know DHS and AOC have some conversations, but from my perspective as a lottery retailer as well as a county commissioner, we can do better, and we should.
Thank you very much. And one concern I have before I let you go, that from the lottery, the 50% or 60% is a net proceed, but at the same time, restaurant, that 50% is the total gross sale. So there's a big difference in it. So that's one of the things we need to consider when we're considering what is the dominant issue. But since you have an appointment at 9:30, I'm going to let you off the hook at this time, but I hope to see you sometime in the near future.
Thank you for the opportunity, Mr. Chairman. Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee.
Thank you. Okay, at this time I'd like to call the Rhonda Hatafi, did I pronounce correctly?
Hatafi.
Thank you. Thank you, Rhonda. Welcome back.
I don't know what I'm doing. I can overdose
like my actual contractual commission. Are you yourself or are you someone else with you?
I am alone today.
Okay.
Actual factual contractual. I like it. Actual factual contractual. I like it.
Peter Wong would like to come sit. We testified together last week. Is it last week?
All right. Welcome, Rhonda.
Thank you very much, Senator Lim. It's great to see you again.
Thank you.
It's been a long time.
Yes.
My name is Rhonda Hatafi. I represent Oregonians for Gambling Awareness Organization. And I have a few things today that I have handed out to you. Testimonies from myself from the Lottery Commission meeting previously. I have letters from my daughter, who is now 16, who lost her uncle when she was seven almost, as well as my other niece, who's 17 now. I have articles from the different newspapers that are recent about problem gambling in our state and some of the problems that it has brought on. So I'm going to go ahead and start with a couple different things today. Again, I'm the founder of Oregonians for Gambling Awareness Organization, and I'm here today to speak because my brother is not. 9 years ago, he took his life after unsuccessfully being able to handle his problem with gambling. His gambling choice was video poker machines. He started at 18 years old and won a scratch ticket of $500. And Bobby, at this point in his life, was a very hard worker, dedicated from the time he was little. He's the one that had the money in his pocket. He's the one that bought birthday or Christmas presents for all of us. There's five kids, and he's always the one that was there with something under the tree for everybody. He liked to save his money. He always stashed it away and would find the one big thing that he wanted, and he'd always have it to go get. So I just wanted to put that out there as a background. He was went through school and got his GED and not his diploma, but was very hardworking and dedicated to his work. And at 28 years old, made $45,000 a year as a steel mill worker. I'm sorry, not steel mill, but I just lost a, worked a, in Portland. It's with steel, but not steel mill, but he, that's what he did. And he was 28 years old, single, made $45,000 a year, and worked very, very hard to get everything he had. And as I said, he would save and get the best that he could get. He liked to have the good things. When he started gambling, more than just the scratch tickets, he would do the Keno every now and then, or he would do the, you know, the Mega Bucks. When video poker came in, his work schedule was such that he would go to work at 3 in the afternoon and get off at 1 in the morning. Nobody was awake at home, and so he would go gamble for a couple of hours and come home and go to bed. That 2 hours started getting longer and longer, and he wasn't getting home till 5 or 6 in the morning, and he'd sleep until it was time to go to work again and get up and start his day over. We noticed that it was a problem when he started asking and borrowing from people who had a lot less money than he did, or that he should have had. It went rather quickly from 91 when the video poker machines come in until 95 when he committed suicide. In the, probably the last year, when we knew that his problem was bigger than he could handle, and he knew at that time it was bigger than he could handle, he didn't come to us anymore. He told us, I've got it licked. I'm doing better. I know it doesn't matter anymore. It doesn't matter what I put in the machine. I realize it's not the bucks anymore. It's just paper to keep me gambling. And I think I've got it all right. He went into counseling. The counselors at that time didn't know how to treat him. And so they put him on antidepressants, which we found out he didn't take because it wasn't what the problem was. They encouraged him to go out and do the things he enjoyed, which is great, except it was outdoors, hunting, fishing, that kind of stuff. He came and got his gun from my parents' house thinking that, you know, we were thinking he was going to go out for the weekend and have a good time. These things that he tried, he cut up his credit cards we found in his safe. He called the Gamblers Anonymous, which was mentioned earlier. And again, as was mentioned, it is a, you know, individual that takes the phone calls and gets that program going. It's all volunteer. The number that he had called at that time was whooping and hollering, and the guy was like, woo, don't call me if you're looking for gambling help because I'm at it again. And the guy was out having a good time. So there, that help wasn't available. The 1% that's available now for treatment wasn't available back 9 years ago, so that money wasn't there. So everywhere he turned, the help was just not there for him. So our last camping trip, our last big trip out as a family, happened July 4th of 95. And as I mentioned, he was in counseling. He had thought he had it under control. He had asked my mom to get on his checking account with them so that he didn't have control of his money anymore. We went into an establishment in the Milwaukee area that was letting him, taking his paycheck and letting him spend it throughout the week, and then on Thursdays he would just go turn his paycheck over to them, so they were fronting him the money every week. And we went in and asked them to stop that, which we thought that they had, but they hadn't. So at this point, we thought everything was going in the right direction. We had a big camping trip. It's my dad's birthday. Everything was good. We look back on the pictures of that day, seeing in his face and in his eyes through the pictures that he was still hurting. He wasn't doing as good as we had hoped he was. That was July 4th. July 20th, he committed suicide. You know, we found him. My parents, my dad, and my two nephews had found him at his house. He had shot himself, something that has affected both my dad and my nephews tremendously, as you can imagine. We were planning on going to a big company picnic of Bobby's to surprise him that day. I was on my way up to Portland to surprise him. He didn't know we were going to be able to make it with my family, which is one of your handouts there. My daughter just wrote, and she told me last night that She'd never let anybody read this paper before. The Lottery Commission meeting, I was getting things together, and she said, "Mom, do you want to take this up there? It's a really, really hard and amazing thing to explain to your children how something like a video poker machine can affect a person to the extreme that they would want to take their life. We are an extremely close family. Bobby was just a year older than I am. And so we grew up together. We were in the same grade because of health problems for him in 1 year, and they held him back. So we went through second grade all the way through together. And so to see my nephew and my niece, who lived with him, with my parents for a while, go through this, it's an amazing, hurtful thing to see. My nephew, who is now in college in Texas, wasn't able to be here for our Awareness Day, which Senator Lim helped us set up 7 years ago. And this is the first year he's ever missed it. He's spoke at different committee meetings. He's went to the Congress with us. He's been on the steps with me every single year to promote this. And he took a week off from college to get through Uncle Bobby's birthday without family. Excuse me. He called me. He emailed me, actually, first. And a picture he went and had tattooed on his shoulder, "Uncle Bobby, rest in peace," because he couldn't stand not doing anything for him on that day. Thank you. And it was so amazing to see, 9 years later, the effect that this has had on us, on our family, on his friends who still call my mom and dad and say, "You know, I can't believe it. I still can't believe he's gone." We started this organization with the hopes of educating others, with the idea that we didn't know what we needed to do to help him. We thought we were doing the right things. We quit loaning him money. My parents had to move out of their house to focus his money in other directions. We thought we were doing all the right things, and obviously we weren't. We want the word to be out there that it is serious. You know, I mean, I hear the talking that was just going on up here about, they have consideration for gambling and their families. He said, not necessarily concern, but consideration. Why can't it be concern? Why does it just have to be considered? As I was preparing this week to come, I have four coworkers who came to me with gambling problems. One is her neighbor, who asked her to please tell my husband that I borrowed money from you you borrowed money from me to get through the month because I spent our money and I don't have it, so he won't question you, so please just cover for me. And she said no. Another lady, her daughter was married for 2 years and divorced because the spouse gambled away everything and they lost everything. She ended up having to move and her child away from the state. Another one whose husband doesn't think he has a real problem with gambling, yet he's hiding it and she's finding little bits of information here and there. And another one whose husband's ex-wife can't afford to pay any of the child support she owes because it's all went into gambling. This isn't drug, alcohol-related problems. This is gambling-related problems. I work at a school. There's very few people comparatively, that work in this area, and there's four of them that approached me to tell me what their problem was with gambling. Last night I went to my son's basketball practice and a parent approached me and said her brother-in-law has lost thousands and thousands of dollars. She said probably between $15,000 and $20,000 in the last 2 months to gambling. And they don't know what to do. They're at a loss. They got a foreclosure on their home, and it was a big surprise. They had no idea. I mean, the wife had no idea it was coming. That's five people this week. This was Wednesday that told me they had problems. My husband is a teacher at a high school. He has two students who have won $3,000 poker jackpots at a little restaurant down in Crestwell that are doing poker tables. $60. You pay your $60. You go in, and you're in. Supposedly the house isn't making any money, so it's not an illegal operation. They're underage. One of them went from a B in class to failing. He didn't pass five classes. He's off the basketball team because of gambling issues that he has at 17 years old. Our goal this year is to target the youth. I think it's an incredible issue that we have before us, and we need to find a way to let our youth know that it is not an okay way to fund our state. It's not an okay way to fund our schools. It's not happening. None of the things that we have tried has solved our problems with money in this state. We've increased the number of machines in restaurants and bars. We've decreased the amount of treatment money and prevention money. We've decreased the money that the commission that goes to the places. None of these things are helping. So we need to, as a state, decide how far are we willing to go to get the money we need for our state. Is the gambling the only thing we're going to offer to fund our state, or are we going to expand that and go into some other illegal activities that are happening right now? Prostitution happens all over the state. Do we need to clean that up, take a grip of it, and try to get some of that money to come in and fund our state? I don't think so. But we need to find out how far are we going to go to try to figure out what's the best way to fund our state.
Okay. Any questions?
Okay. Question, Mr. Chair?
Yes, Representative Buckley.
Yes, thank you, Ron. First, I'm very sorry for your loss. Of the programs that you've researched in the past number of years, are there any programs you found or heard that have been particularly effective for problem gambling?
You know, I'm very fortunate to live in Lane County, and Lane County has one of the best treatment and prevention programs, I believe, in the state. If the gamblers get there and they continue to work through the program, the emergence program that we offer there, I think, is very effective. Gambling does have the highest rate of fallback, that gamblers go back into it because of the availability of gambling. You know, I mean, it's everywhere, which are some of the things I would like to see change in this state, is how available it is.
Okay, and if you have any questions, please hold at this time, and we will go to the Mr. Philip Kennedy Wong. Is your name? Okay, welcome.
Thank you very much, Chairman, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Philip Kennedy Wong. I represent EMO. We're the State Association of Churches, representing 17 Christian denominations. I want to start first by thanking Rhonda for sharing her story. It was very difficult for me to hear, and it can be challenging for me to sort of follow up, you know, in terms of the relative importance of what she just experienced, which is, you know, her personal testimony, how gambling affected her life. Let me begin by going over our statement, which you have before you, and essentially, let me just say, Ecumenical Ministries of Oregon is opposed to state-sponsored gambling. For two primary areas. One is that we don't see it as sound budget policy, and second, also on a personal morality standpoint. We do not support any proposal that increases the state's reliance on gaming revenue to fund essential public services. In fact, we would like to see government get out of the gaming business altogether. In fact, the only role we see government playing is reducing its harmful effects on families and communities and regulating its application, so we don't have further stories like Rhonda's to share. We believe it is unwise for state government, to fund state government with gaming revenue. Government should, in principle, be funded in general by tax revenue. Given the inherent fiscal instability of the state's budget, we believe that tax reform is the more appropriate response, and this means creating a stable tax system and revenue system that guarantees a full school year for all children, a safety net for the vulnerable, and safe communities in good times and in bad times. As I said earlier, sound budget policy is not expanding gaming for more revenue. This would be akin to the state encouraging more people to drink alcohol, to smoke, or to gamble, or even like what Rhonda suggested, perhaps even prostitution for more gaming revenue, and that is immoral, we believe, for the state to engage in. Would the state need to increase more gamblers, drinkers, and smokers in order to balance the budget or to fund important public services every single time there's a budget shortfall? Instead, EMO and I'm sure others would be more than happy to work with lawmakers, the governor, to look at and to develop economic development strategies to replace lost gaming revenue. We are more than happy to work on programs that will promote Oregon products or to promote Oregon workers, which leads me to our second point in terms of the personal morality aspects of how gambling affects our society. There is no compelling public interest for government to promote gambling. Gambling is addictive and it preys upon the vulnerable. In fact, state sponsorship and advertisements of gaming sends a wrong message to our communities and to our children. And more importantly, it undervalues earning money from hard work. It kind of gives you the false notion that you can get a lot of in return for putting very little in. And that's not good. We want to promote hard work in our society. We believe the proper role for you as lawmakers, for government, is to limit its negative impacts and to regulate its application so we don't have more stories like the story of Rhonda's brother. In gaming establishments, in addition, and I applaud Mr. McCollum earlier for being supportive of services that treat gambling addiction, but we need to fund it adequately. And I think he suggested, as well as many others, recognize that the funding for these types of programs is critical. In fact, I mean, as much as we promote personal responsibility, obviously it gets to a point when a person is addictive, they don't have any sense of control over their personal choices. And I think that we as a society do have an obligation to take care of all of those within our community. And if that means intervening on someone's behalf to help them get back on the right course, get them to be more responsible, we're all very supportive of that. But that won't happen unless there are some sort of social commitment to fund counseling or gambling addiction prevention services, and also greater awareness. I applaud the work that Rhonda's doing. And I also want to acknowledge the question that Representative Riley brought up, in that how do you spot a problem gambler? And I don't know if there is an easy way to spot a problem gambler. There are some things that we can do. There were like some ideas suggested by Jeff Murata at the Lottery Commission, such as putting some sort of controls on the video machines that sort of times out or tells you how much money you've already put into the particular arcade that you're playing with. So that way it gives the user a greater sense of control over what it is that they're doing and a better understanding of how much personal investment, not just money-wise, but time-wise, that they spend away from work or spend away from family, that they're putting into these video games. And finally, we must loosen the hold of state-sponsored gaming with modest steps, like reducing commissions paid out to retailers. And these commissions can go towards more counseling and gambling addiction services. In fact, I want to comment earlier on something that Mr. McCollum said in terms of how do we define what a casino is. Well, for us, it's very simple. It's any establishment that makes more money from its gaming than from other goods or services. I don't think we need to move down the path of developing some sort of complex, nuanced definition of what a casino is. Casinos, as you can tell from watching television or going into Las Vegas, they come in all shapes and sizes. I mean, you go into a 7-Eleven, there's, you know, line games. So I think any time when you have an establishment that makes more money from gaming, it is a casino. That's a very simple definition. And we do have that in the state of Oregon, unfortunately. Finally, I want to leave you with a statement from the Evangelical Lutheran Church of America, which is a member denomination of EMO. There are two types of concerns. I think as lawmakers, you should be concerned of these two concerns, which I'll read, and then I want to leave you also with some personal concerns that gambling has on our society. As a state, we want to, I mean, as U.S. state lawmakers, let me read you this. Legalized gambling tends to extract revenues from those who may be least able to resist the temptation to gamble, rather than those who ought to be paying to support state programs. Studies have indicated that the disposition of low-income families spend a greater fraction of income on gambling as other items such as food or alcohol than higher-income families. This means that receipts from gambling become another regressive tax when used as a source of revenue, and that's exactly what we're doing. We're using gambling as tax and budget policies, which is an invalid application. Second, legalized gambling may also encourage more illegal gambling, such as the example that Rhonda brought up with the kids on her basketball team. I mean, that may be a legal operation in terms of the law, but in many ways, in our eyes, that's illegal gambling because it sort of goes under the radar. So illegal gambling is very problematic because if the state supports gambling as a worthwhile pursuit, then it does send a broader message of social acceptance of what gambling, I mean, as gambling as a state funding source, and that means, you know, we'll have kids like Rhonda's kids attempted by gaming at a very young age. As far as the personal morality side, which is something obviously as a religious organization we are very concerned about, gambling increases the number or further degrades those maladjusted persons who take refuge from the problems of life by indulging compulsively in gambling. It diverts personal and family income from basic business, professional, and civic services essential to community well-being. And lastly, it contributes to an increase in broken homes or undermines the moral fiber, character, and integrity of people and community by giving public sanction to covetous desires to get rich quickly at the expense of their neighbors without providing any skills or services which enrich the life of all of our communities. And with that, I thank you very much for the opportunity to present testimony.
Thank you very much. Okay. Vice Chair Mockley.
Thank you for both your testimony, and Rana, thank you very much for sharing your story with us. One of the points Mr. McCallum made shortly ago was that because the internet has now kind of changed the options available to people, he raised the question of whether the state controls gambling. If that just doesn't simply, if the state reduces gambling, does that just result in people turning their selves to internet sites, which then takes them out of the loop of treatment and out of the loop of the revenues going to the state? And that's kind of a new question, in that the internet didn't exist when your brother became addicted. And as a head of an organization that deals with this issue, do you have any insights, or Mr. Long, do you have any insights on this question?
You're correct in saying that, you know, that is a new issue that has been brought forward, and I know I've spoken with a few family members of gamblers who gamble online and who actually removed the computer from the home so that he could no longer gamble, which in turn was difficult on her children who were in school and needed the computer for worthwhile issues. And I don't have an answer for you as far as, you know, what's the best way to handle that. I know that, you know, Oregon offers so many different types of gambling with the casinos involved in there also, that there's so many options out there that I don't remember which one said it, but gambling is here to stay. That is going to be something that we're going to have to deal with. But the availability of the video poker machines in so-called family restaurants, you know, and in the delis and those kinds of things that make it available, I think, are a greater threat maybe than because they're removing them from the home. But I don't know. I mean, I'm just not sure where to go with that.
Chairman and Representative Merkley, I mean, that's a very good point in terms of, like, the prevalence of gaming and with, you know, the prevalence of the Internet and people having access to it, I think is very problematic. But I don't think it is undoable in terms of reining it in. There are other morally corrosive things that come on the Internet, and we as a really, as a society, have looked at ways where we can rein it in, for example, creating filters or creating some sort of system that locks out certain websites that may be predatory in nature, and that's what, you know, gaming is. I don't think it's beyond our reach. Obviously, internet-based commerce is something that states have looked into regulating. I don't see it as too differently in terms of how we approach this problem of gaming.
Follow-up question. Mr. Chair, thank you. One of these articles that was passed out referred to a state, I believe it was North Carolina, that decided to significantly reduce its public gambling, I think by ending video poker gambling.
Correct.
And has there been any sort of follow-up to understand, and I think that may bear on this Internet question, whether there was a reduction in addiction level or whether people simply went to nearby states, to the Internet, so on and so forth?
I don't know the exact number, but I know that video poker has the highest rate of addiction for people who are in treatment. That's their game of choice. And I know in North Carolina when that was happening, they did have a huge decrease in their treatment, in numbers of people needing treatment when the video poker machines were removed. So, but I don't have the current numbers for that.
Thank you.
Thanks. And Rhonda, and thank you very much for coming from New Jersey area. Some time ago, you were opposing or eliminating this video poker game from our state. Have you changed your focus instead of eliminating it? More awareness, more education, more prevention? What is your point at this time?
I wouldn't say that I've eliminated it. I you know, backed away from eliminating it. I still would like to see that happen. I think that video poker is still the most addictive form of gambling that we offer, and I think that it is the most hurtful as far as families go in our state. So I would like to see it removed, but at this time, financially, and is having the backing to do that has been very, very difficult to come by.
Okay. The problem is not the person who are gambling, also the most addicted is the state government.
You're right.
And that's the real problem. Mm-hmm. And by the way, this is not the only time we're hearing it. We will continue to hear on this issue in the future because this is a crucial issue for our state. Mm-hmm. And thank you very much for coming. And I'd like to call at this time Mary Jo Killingsworth. And Jeffrey Morata, and since, where is Jeffrey Morata? Yes, and you are going to, we are going to give you the later because you have some presentations. So let's go to the individual presentation first. If you have patience with us, we appreciate it. Okay, Mary, welcome.
Thank you. Mine is just another sob story. I heard about this forum on my way to work this morning, so I thought I'd take some time off and to stop in. Yesterday celebrated one anniversary of my sister-in-law's suicide from gambling addiction. My brother, we have also a history of cancer, and I would say that the gambling is much worse than the cancer in my family. My brother was in the military, and he retired here to help care for my parents as they got older. And in 1990, he died of cancer, and that left my sister-in-law set. She worked for the state, and anyway, right around that time, the casino opened up at Spirit Mountain and both casinos. So if it wasn't one, it was the other. And so she would trade her loneliness for gambling. So she lost her home and her cars and her credit. And being military, she was a very frugal person, very, very frugal. And sewed her own clothes and, you know, watched every penny. But gambling is a mental illness. And so we estimated about $500 to maybe $700,000 went to Spirit Mountain. So when this man that was over here was talking about down in their county, $500,000, we're talking one person from Northeast Salem contributing that much. And how does she funnel through a system that we have that did not help her? You have to reach out for the help. And she wouldn't. I mean, I'm going to send you her suicide note. I happened to come across it last night. But in that note, it said, I couldn't beat it. And if you know anybody, tell them to get help. These people do not seek help. It's too embarrassing to them. Mm-hmm. So, also, I don't understand how somebody in a gambling position can file bankruptcy so many times. We've got a problem in the bankruptcy court. I don't understand how these people continue to go get automobile loans at 300% and continue to lose their cars. That is another issue. She was involved in bookies. People, I don't even know what a bookie is or where you find them. She was involved in bookies through Spirit Mountain.
What's the bookies?
Bookies is where you go get money at higher interest rate. So she was involved in some, you know, activity that way. I don't know. I mean, I know what happened through the kids. She has three children. She ruined her kids' credit. So now we're also working on to the grandkids. So we're talking three generations just since Spirit Mountain opened up in 1990 when my brother died. These kids, her children, are adults. They've all filed bankruptcy because of their mother. So it's really a sad, sad story. She was German. She came from Germany. Her brother came for the funeral. Try to explain Oregon's gambling to somebody from out of the country. They do not fathom it. They do not get it. Nor can I explain it. And gambling is clearly a mental addiction. It's our understanding that they have to treat these people on a one-on-one basis like they do sex addicts. It is not like a physical addiction to coffee or to coke or to drugs or alcohol. It was different. But also with her went alcohol addiction. It just goes with gambling. So one thing I was glad to see at Spirit Mountain is at least they don't sell alcohol on the floor. You got to go into the bar. But, you know, she worked for the state. She's a reputable citizen. She paid her taxes until gambling took it. And if that wasn't enough, this past year has been really hard. A year ago, my brother, he studied to be a priest. He lived in Portland. He was married, family, and everything. He was a very religious person in the Catholic Church. He had cancer, and he died. And his son, who is a Boston University graduate, flew out here, didn't have the money. Well, that's interesting. He has a wonderful job being $150,000 a year. Well, when my brother died, where was my nephew? Absent. Where was he? In the casino. It's a horrible problem to come from Washington, D.C. out here to seek Oregon for your refuge for your gambling addiction. I mean, we're affecting other states, clearly. Then, if that's not enough, in my own marriage, I divorced after 28 years. What was my husband addicted to? Video poker machines. He was addicted early in our marriage at one point, and he beat it, so to speak. We owned six homes. We built houses at least once a year. We were that was a side job. We were in construction, but I worked for an insurance company here in town. He worked for Freightliner Corporation in Portland. He worked nights. Video poker is available on off hours. And for him, what also went with it is pornography and gambling and everything else that is immoral that goes with poker. When I divorced him, I had $20,000 left. You know, from there he went into DUIs. You know, reputable people. These are good, you know, good people. Now, I work for this insurance company north of town. They have moved 1,500 jobs out of state. Why in the world can't we work on keeping those jobs in our city, in our state, rather than let them go instead of going for revenue for gambling? This is just one family. One immediate family, but I'm seeing it into my nieces and my nephew's generation. I'm seeing it into my great nephews, and it's gambling, plain and simple. And in every one of those situations, nobody, my nephew, my ex-husband, or my sister-in-law, would seek treatment. So the treatment that is supposed to be earmarked for these people is not getting to them, and it's because of embarrassment. And we all have our demons. And now, 2 weeks after my brother died, my sister died of cancer. 2 weeks after that, my sister-in-law committed suicide. My sister, I am in charge of her estate. She's the one that died in the middle. What am I going through in that estate? Gambling. She was gambling. Even to this day, I'm getting mail from Herald's Club, from Spirit Mountain, from all these places gambling. I did not see her as having a horrible gambling addiction. So it's like anything else. I mean, I can go to that casino, and I can go in with $10 and get my free cup of coffee, and I can walk out. But there are so many people that cannot, and those are the people that are falling through the cracks. And I don't know what to say. It's like any other addiction. If it's truly an addiction, we've got a big problem. So, you know, I think we need to look at revenue trying to keep the jobs we have that are funneling out of the state than we are to really go to more, especially the video poker machines in a family situation or where there is alcohol or other immoral places, because I've seen, you know, I clearly have seen the pornography, the loans, the, you know, the bankruptcies. We're talking lots of money. I mean, in my case, we've gone through $300,000 easily. I'm now losing my job because my job is going to Jacksonville, Florida. And it's pretty sad that I've lost my whole net worth due to gambling, and I'm at 55 years old. So these people are secondary generations that are going to be affect our whole Social Security system, everything else. We're going to be, you know, these kids are going to be dependent. It's very, very sad, but it's the truth. I think there's a better way to make revenue.
Okay, thank you very much. Where did you hear this public hearing today?
I heard it on KBZY at 7:30 on my way to work.
Okay. Is it all right this morning?
Yes.
Thank you. Any questions from the panel?
What number is that, Mr. Chair?
371-1490 is their phone number. Is that the number?
Oh, no, I wondered what on the dial.
1490.
Thank you
for
coming.
A.M.
Okay, so thank you very much, and totally sympathize the situation you are in when your family's died out of gambling problem, also a cancer, and on top of that you lost your job. But
well, you know, probably the biggest tragedy in this whole thing is my daughter got married and I could not give her a wedding because I had worked my whole life and it went to gambling.
Okay.
And you know, but I'm just one story. I'm just one story, and my family has been really hit. But I do know that those programs aren't out there for people who don't seek it. And it's just, something is happening. I mean, you know, we need to open our eyes. It's just there.
Gambling is a hidden disease. And that's also a hidden tax. And also mental disease. And the problem is bigger than what you think, what I think. And sometimes it is very difficult to detect because they try to hide.
It is, yeah. It's clearly a mental disease. And I've witnessed personally these people struggle, you know, with their own demons. And But I'll look at each one of you and know that we're all human. And we've all come short of the glory of God. But I'll tell you that that is one demon that some people can't fight.
Okay.
And I don't know. I couldn't help any of them, and I still can't. But I think if we make it less available, that it will help. That's all I can say.
Right.
You know, I mean, a lot of people are making money off of it, and I can understand, you know, that it is bringing big revenue. But what about the ones that are falling through the cracks? There's got to be a better way to find them.
Okay. Thank you very much for coming. Appreciate it.
Who should be the next person? And then just the information discusses in order, but you can see that Justin Martin.
Okay, at this time I'd like to call the Justin Martin, Grand Grand Tribe.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Justin Martin, and I'm here today on behalf of the Confederated Tribes of Grand Ronde, where I'm also a tribal member. I've also recently been working with the Oregon Tribal Gaming Alliance, and along with Mr. McCallum, sit as a board member with the Oregon Gambling Addiction Treatment Foundation, and I'm very glad to see Dr. Moretta here today for you guys to get that information. Thank you very much for the opportunity to share some information with the committee. I will be brief today and cover 3 points. First, I'll give you a little snapshot of the Confederated Tribes of Grand Ronde, and then talk about some specific economic impacts in and around our community, and then talk a little bit about the broader spectrum of Indian gaming here in Oregon, and then finally talk briefly about regulation and problem gambling and some of the steps that we are taking in terms of gambling awareness and addiction. The Confederated Tribes of Grand Ronde are a confederation made up currently of 5 tribes, about 35 miles west of Salem and about 60 miles southwest of Portland. The enrolled membership is about a little over 5,000 members. Originally, 26 bands were moved to the Grand Ronde Reservation in 1855. They existed on the reservation there. We existed on the reservation there. Throughout time, some of that land dwindled, ultimately ending in termination in the 1950s under a federal policy, the Federal Termination Act, in which Douglas McKay was Secretary of the Interior, a former Oregon governor. It took 29 years until the tribe was restored, and we were restored in name only under an act of Congress, the 1983 Grand Ronde Restoration Act. It then took 5 more years for us to get some land back in another act of Congress in the Grand Ronde Reservation Act of 1988. We currently have about 9,800 acres of contiguous timberland that make up the reservation. Economically, the Confederated Tribes of Grand Ronde have been very successful with the onset of Indian gaming in Oregon. We opened in 1995. We are the largest employer in Polk County, and we're very proud to say that those revenues have really went to making a difference in our efforts for self-sufficiency and achieving things for our tribal membership. We have been able to put those dollars into education, health care, elder pensions, housing, and again, a lot of employment for the entire community. We are very proud of that, but we also have a long way to go in making up for a lot of years of need. That being said, what I've brought for you today is specifically some numbers that I'm very proud to say the Oregon Tribal Gaming Alliance has commissioned a study with Eco Northwest, here in Oregon, and this is a little bit of a sneak preview. We have not yet released this information, but I'd like to touch on some of the things that Indian Gaming is doing for Oregon. Directly supporting 5,328 jobs and $192 million in wages and benefits in 2003. We generated another 5,640 jobs indirectly and $156 million in income for workers in other sectors of Oregon's economy. And I think it's important to point out that that is namely rural. Oregon tribes have collectively invested more than $250 million in infrastructure since the first bingo hall in 1992. Another interesting point is that Oregon tribes' capital expenditures in hotel casinos equals 11.4% of all money spent in the state on hotel, amusement, social, and recreational building construction since 92. That is one out of every $9. Finally, Indian Gaming has given back to communities in the form of charitable and nonprofit organizations. Those are dollars not going to the general fund, but again, specifically to charitable and nonprofit organizations in the areas of the arts, shelter, domestic violence, health and well-being, and problem gaming. This year, Spirit Mountain Community Fund and the Confederated Tribes of Grand Ronde are going to be proud to give back their $30 million to those organizations. Oftentimes, there are questions of taxes. You will see in the handout I've provided, because of economic activity in the year 2003, state and local governments collected more than $42.6 million in taxes and other revenue, while saving $7 million in public assistance costs because of the statewide employment impact. We are very proud of those numbers, and we're very proud, again, of what we're doing in rural Oregon. Some questions often come up about regulation and who pays. Oregon tribes in 2003 joined with the state to spend more than $18.2 million to regulate gaming. Tribes picked up 61% of those regulatory costs, even though they account for only 36% of the gaming conducted here inside Oregon. I also wanted to mention problem gambling and some of the steps that the Confederated Tribes have taken with respect to awareness. We have worked through the Oregon Gambling Addiction Treatment Foundation in funding studies in 1997, two of them, the year 2000, 2001, and are working currently, again, to see what we can do above and beyond as a responsible business owner in the community and throughout the state when it comes to problem gambling and awareness. In sum, I think tribes have done a wonderful job in providing economy to rural Oregon, not just looking out for tribal membership and tribal government, but also reaching out to the larger community and looking out for tribal and non-tribal members. Thank you.
Any questions? Okay.
Thank you, Chair.
Yes. Vice Chair Boone.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Justin. I appreciate that. What is the tribe's position, if any, on the state's discussion right now about expanding into line games?
Mr. Chair, Vice Chair Boone, at this time, the Confederated Tribes of Grand Ronde do not have an opinion on that. Obviously, we look and have an interest in any expansion of gaming in Oregon, not just for the impact upon our own communities and employment, but also because of the impact on the citizens of Oregon. Impacts not only with economic development, but also in problem gambling and gambling awareness.
Thanks.
You mentioned that you were looking at the problem gambling treatment. What percentage, what dollar amount do you use for the treatment?
Out of the, Chairman and members of the committee, out of the 6% community fund, there is a dedicated stream that goes towards problem gambling. There are certain criteria within the fund, public safety, education, the arts, health, housing, and problem gaming has a specific line item. I do not have the exact totals of what we have done, but I can get that through what you see here on the handout, the five specific studies that we have funded, but I can get that information to you in the committee.
Yeah, would you please, because the state government provides not less than 1% providing for the treatment. I hope the U.S. also do the same thing or even better for the treatment. I do appreciate it. Okay.
Thank you.
Oh. Representative Buckley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Justin, I'd like to ask the same question I've asked previous witnesses. In your experience, are there programs that work? Are there gambling treatment programs that are more effective than others that you can recommend?
Chairman Lim, Representative Buckley, it's nice today that we have Dr. Murata in the room. He can speak much more specifically to specific programs. But again, I want to reiterate to the committee, we think it is key, we think it is critically important to raise the awareness of problem gambling and to raise the awareness of programs that we help sponsor through the foundation that ultimately can deliver a positive benefit to the community.
Thank you.
All right. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
We are going to go about the public hearing meeting until the 10:30 today, so please bear with us. And we have several other members who like to testify. At this time, I'd like to call my chair, Michael Lamb, the Friends of the Columbia Gorge. Is he here?
Yeah, I'm here.
Oh, okay. Thank you.
I didn't realize I was on deck, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Welcome.
Thank you. I have some prepared testimony, too, that I'd like to provide to the committee.
Good morning, Chair Lim and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Michael Lang. I'm Conservation Director for Friends of the Columbia Gorge. A little bit about Friends of the Columbia Gorge. We're a nonprofit organization with members in over 3,000 households. We're dedicated to protecting the scenic beauty, the natural and the cultural heritage of the Columbia River Gorge. We appreciate the opportunity to provide public testimony on gambling issues. And I should state right away that Friends doesn't have a position in general on gambling or on casinos. We're an environmental watchdog group. We also lead hikes in the gorge, so we do a lot of recreation. We do take positions on development proposals that would harm the resources of the Columbia River Gorge or harm the communities in the Columbia River Gorge, too. And that is the reason why I'm here today to talk to the committee. As the committee is aware, the Confederated Tribes of the Warm Springs Reservation have proposed a large casino in the Columbia River Gorge, a 500,000-square-foot casino resort in the heart of the gorge in the town of Cascade Locks. The current proposal involves purchasing land that's currently not Indian land and then siting a casino nearly 70 miles away from the reservation boundary within Cascade Locks and along the banks of the Columbia River. Casino advocates are asking Governor Kulongoski to support this proposal for what would be Oregon's first off-reservation casino. Currently, all existing tribal casinos in Oregon are located on reservation lands. Oregon's current policy regarding tribal casinos requires casinos to be on reservation lands and limits casinos to one facility per tribe. This policy has provided revenue for the tribes, obviously, and also prevents the proliferation of casinos throughout the state. The proposal for an off-reservation casino in Cascade Locks in the Columbia River Gorge would break this existing policy and turn Indian gaming in Oregon on its head. Friends of the Columbia Gorge is opposed to this casino proposal for the following reasons. The Cascade Locks casino proposal is estimated by the tribes to draw 3 million visitors a year to the small town of Cascade Locks. That's more visitors than visit Multnomah Falls, the greatest attraction in the Columbia River Gorge on an annual basis. It would cause significant traffic congestion on Interstate 84. It would cause unplanned growth to the small town of Cascade Locks, increased air pollution in the Columbia River Gorge from the traffic that it would generate. Already there's an air pollution problem that's quite significant in the Columbia River Gorge. The Forest Service and our state air quality agencies have determined that air quality is degraded 95% of the days during the year, and no significant steps have been introduced to really address this problem at all. We're also concerned that this growth pressure from the casino would result in pressure to expand the urban growth boundary of Cascade Locks The urban areas in the gorge are not set in stone. They can be expanded, and we're concerned that this sort of unplanned growth pressure would cause or may result in expanding the urban growth boundary into surrounding scenic area lands. We're also very concerned about the precedent that this proposal would set if it's approved. The approval of a gorge casino would set a precedent leading to more off-reservation casinos within the Columbia River Gorge and also throughout the state by breaking the state's current policy barring off-reservation casinos. In addition, at least one other tribe has previously expressed interest in building a casino in the Columbia River Gorge, and they may in fact be waiting to see what the outcome of the proposal is for Cascade Locks. The Indian Gaming Regulatory Act is the federal law that governs tribal casinos. Under the Indian Gaming Regulatory Act, off-reservation casinos that are proposed on land purchased after 1988, the year that the Indian Gaming Regulatory Act was passed, require dual approval. A tribe has to apply for the casino to the Secretary of Interior, and the Secretary of Interior may approve the casino if it meets certain criteria. Then the Secretary's decision, if approved, goes to the governor of the state where the casino is proposed. And then this governor may concur or not concur with the Secretary of Interior's decision. So it's a dual approval process requiring the approval of both the federal government and the governor of the state where the casino is opposed. In this particular case with an off-reservation casino, we believe it's likely that Oregon's governor may be bound by Article 15, Section 4, Sub 12 of the Oregon Constitution, which prohibits casinos from operating in the state of Oregon. And I don't know if you're aware, there's currently some litigation with the Florence-based casino over this issue. We're not involved in that litigation. Secretary of Interior Gail Norton, who has authority over tribal gaming proposals, has previously expressed concern over off-reservation casinos and the proliferation of gambling under the Indian Gaming Regulatory Act. In a letter to Governor George Pataki of New York in 2002, Norton said, "While I do not intend to signal an absolute bar on off-reservation gaming, I am extremely concerned that the principles underlying the enactment of the Indian Gaming Regulatory Act are being stretched in ways that Congress never imagined. Nationally, off-reservation casinos are very rare. As of 2003, the National Indian Gaming Association reported that there are only 3 off-reservation casinos on newly acquired land in the entire country. In 2003, there were 354 tribal gaming facilities in the country, and less than 1% of them are off-reservation. Again, none of those are in Oregon. There may have been 1 or 2 approved since that time. I believe there was one added in Washington State. In the 1990s, Attorney General Kulongoski raised significant concerns over the proliferation of gambling and also casinos in the state, calling it something akin to an arms race. Today, Governor Kulongoski is considering upping the ante on this arms race by breaking the state's policy on gambling and supporting an off-reservation casino in the Columbia River Gorge. As Attorney General Kulongoski, and I've provided a copy of this article in the New York Times to you, he penned an article called "When Gambling Calls the Shots." He warned of expanded gambling markets in Oregon in which gambling drives public policy, not the other way around. With expanded lottery games and 6 on-reservation casinos, Attorney General Kulongoski warned that Oregon now has a bad case of what is called a level playing field, something akin to an arms race. That's a quote. Oregon now has 9 casinos, is considering expanding gaming, state-sponsored gaming, and a proposal for Oregon's first off-reservation casino in the heart of the Columbia River Gorge. We believe throwing out Oregon's policy banning off-reservation casinos would only escalate the concerns expressed by Attorney General Kulongoski in 1996, and we hope that this legislature and the governor would heed that advice and the warning issued in the 1990s, because we believe it's still valid today. The Columbia River Gorge should be protected for our children and future generations and not turned into a mecca for people seeking to gamble in casinos.
The Warm Springs Reservation spans 660,000 acres. It's more than twice the size of the Columbia River Gorge National Scenic Area. We believe that there's a solution there that's on reservation. There's a major highway running through the reservation. Tribal officials have publicly stated that the biggest problem facing the tribe is rampant unemployment on reservation, with tribal members estimated at 60% unemployment. We believe that a new casino on Highway 26 would generate added revenue for the tribes, would provide more jobs for tribal members, and would keep intact our current policy on tribal gaming casinos, and would also protect the Columbia River Gorge. And that would conclude my prepared testimony. I'd be happy to ask or answer any questions.
Okay, Representative Dellum.
Yes, Michael, Confederate Tribes of the Warm Springs have an option to build in Hood River on land that they own?
Chairman, Representative Dellum, the Warm Springs Tribe does own some land on the east side of Hood River.
Thank you. Am I to understand by your testimony, and they do have a legal option to build on that land, a legal bona fide by the Department of Interior, by the state, option to build on that land. Is that correct?
We believe it is not correct, no.
If that were proven to be correct, would you then prefer that the tribe build in Hood River rather than Cascade Locks?
Representative, since the tribe cannot build on the land east of Hood River, we believe it is not an option. In fact, there are several legal reasons why they can't build on that land. And perhaps even more importantly, there are important logistical and practical reasons why really a casino could not be built and would be completely impractical at that site.
One follow-up. And are you a member of any one of the Confederated Tribes of the Warm Springs?
No, I am not.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Okay. If it's not the Indian tribes casino built in Cascade Lock area, those areas are currently depressed. And what are the viable options for that area for economic development, if not this gambling establishment?
Mr. Chair, I'm trying to recall the name of the business, but I read in the Dallas Chronicle a couple of weeks ago a business, manufacturing business, that was going to locate in Cascade Locks but instead moved to the Dalles because they did not want to operate a business next to a large mega casino. I think the prospects of a casino are turning away other manufacturing jobs from the port area in Cascade Locks. I believe Cascade Locks is the most beautiful part of the Columbia River Gorge. The recreational opportunities there are abundant. Economic development, for example, with the proposed sailing facility and sailing resort there, would provide a lot of jobs and also revenue to the town of Cascade Locks. Friends of the Columbia Gorge has, on an annual basis, probably put several thousand dollars at least into the economy of the Columbia River Gorge by renting out the Sternwheeler for events that we have. That's about $7,000 a pop. Our organization has also supported economic development grants and loans for Cascade Locks through the National Scenic Area Act and also other federal programs and state programs. And we've partnered with city officials and with the port to mutually support economic development that is suitable for the community and also for the surrounding National Scenic Area lands. We even donated $100 to help buy a swing set for the county park that's along the river there. So, you know, we believe in general that the future of economic development is taking full advantage of recreation, natural resource-based recreation that is so abundant for that region, and also drawing manufacturing jobs, which unfortunately one was turned away because they felt that the site was too close to the proposed casino and unsuitable. But that's what we believe the future is and the solution for Cascade Locks.
Okay. Did I hear correctly from you that this casino is more advisable in the area of Highway 26 instead of Columbia River area?
Mr. Chair, we believe that would be a viable solution.
So this is just a windy attitude. Is it not?
There's a state's and a federal interest in protecting the National Scenic Area. It's a national scenic treasure. It's not a NIMBY interest. We think there's a higher public value to protecting places like the Columbia River Gorge. But then also there's a precedental effect by breaking the state's policy regarding off-reservation casinos. This isn't just about one casino in the Columbia River Gorge. It could lead and open the door to more casinos in the gorge and more off-reservation casinos throughout the state of Oregon. So there's an important consideration for the entire state of Oregon. What is the future of gambling and casinos in our state? And is the current policy working? We believe it is. Of course, you're right. We don't want a casino in the Columbia River Gorge. But if there is going to be a change, there has to be a solution for the entire state and something that's fair to the other eight tribes in the state of Oregon, too. Not just really an arbitrary treatment of one tribe's proposal. We know of other tribes that have proposed off-reservation casinos during this current administration. They've had the door slammed on them. Is it fair really to say no, no, no to other tribes and then, yes to the Warm Springs tribe that comes in with an off-reservation casino proposal? It doesn't appear to be fair.
Well, thank you very much. I think you're well spoken. One of the things I'm concerned, the constitutionality of the casino built in the Cascade Lock area is off Indian Reservation compound. And our constitution clearly states that no casinos in Oregon, and then coming into the land owned by the Oregon, not the reservations, I don't believe it is the right way constitutionally. And so I'm pursuing on the issue with the Legislative Council and also with the Attorney General to make sure that the governor's move building the casino in Cascade Lock area is that has a right, has the constitutional authority to do that. So we are going to pursue continually on that issue. Okay. But thank you
thank
very
you,
much.
Mr. Chair.
Yes.
Thanks.
And who is the next?
You have only two left here, Mr.
Morata,
and you have this person here.
Okay, Mr. Morata, and hold on. How long do you think it will take to complete your presentation?
I'd say 20 minutes to 30 minutes.
Okay, since we are going to close 10:30, we might not have enough time to complete your testimony. So if you could come back a later time, which we will arrange, we deeply appreciate it. And then sorry for your inconvenience. At this time, I'd like to call the person, and Steve Gilbert. From the Lane County, what's that?
Yes, good morning. Yeah, I'm Steve Gilbert from Eugene. I'm one of your lottery retailers. I have two locations in Eugene. And I just had a few points and questions that I've been thinking about lately, and I heard about this meeting. I thought it might be a good point to come up. The question is, how does the state raise the money that it needs for its programs? There's a gambling option. Our governor calls for a new budget that is asking for more money from the state lottery. In doing so, he's asking for them to add line games. Dr. Morata, who just got cut off, justifiably, I guess, I listened to him speak to the lottery commission meeting 2 weeks ago. And basically, the short story that he presented to them was that by adding line games, he believes that it's going to cost the state through various agencies, just the rough numbers, $46 million a year. It'll bring in 8,000 new problem gamblers to the state, and you could expect 1,000 more divorces. I guess that's per year. He can correct me. So that was his information in one sentence. The governor wants to raise money from the line games, $60 million a year, for the state police. With a cost of $46 million a year,
bankruptcies and divorces, it doesn't seem to quite equate for me that we're going to raise $60 million a year by adding line games with that cost when it clearly does not evaluate the personal costs associated with divorces, bankruptcies, lost jobs. I left that meeting, and the next day I read in the paper, though, that the Lottery Commission voted unanimously to add line games. It kind of perplexes me that they could come up with that. Second question or point that I've got is the casino at Cascade Locks. As was stated earlier, the Oregon Constitution bans the creation or prohibits casinos. However, our governor is going to tax them to locate on non-casino land. So he's going to raise money for the state through that. It doesn't seem to me that that follows our Constitution, and how many other locations are going to follow. Again, raising money for the state through taxing. Is this how we're going to do it? My third point is restaurants and bars, which that's my group. Yes, they're dependent on this income, no doubt about it. And since 1994, when the video poker machines got placed, it has been a critical part of their income. Businesses have been bought and sold based on that income. It's a simple valuation. What's the value of that business? And that's what they're sold at. However, I believe that in 1994, Oregon, through the Lottery Commission, has created a new industry, and that is lottery delis, which I think you could make the point that they somewhat resemble casinos. Point number four is something I just got when I came in, was talking about internet options for gambling. And my opinion there is the argument justifying state-run gambling industry should not be based on other gambling options that are available. The everybody else is doing it argument to me is not a sound one. You know, it's if you're I won't go that far. My fifth point: Indian casinos. This is something I truly have a question on. I understood that in South Dakota, the state can actually regulate or ban certain games played on casinos on tribal lands. I don't know the answer to that, but it would seem to me, and the challenges that we've got here, we've got video poker. The state is going to begin losing money to these casinos if we just maintain video poker. It's going to start eroding. The income's not going to be coming. And so it's a simple question. If you take out, if you can regulate that, that does make the other lottery locations more viable in the presence of these casinos. The other statement that I heard at the Lottery Commission meeting in talking about line games and promoting them is that in the casinos, the line games outnumber video poker games 18-1. And they are positioned based on popularity. So that tells you how popular the line games are in comparison to video poker. So I think that is something that's certainly worth looking into. If we can somehow regulate what games are played, one, that helps the state with its retailers in the presence of this increasing competition. And my last point is, again, somewhat for Dr. Murata. Problem gambling is mandated at 1% of lottery revenues, proceeds. And for that program, my question is this. It really disappoints me and disturbs me. I would like to know how the legislature can justify not fully funding a program as critical as this. You know, just because the state's budget needs money
they've got a cash cow out of the lottery, and they're not going to fund it at the full 1% that it deserves. You know, we're glad to take the money, and then we're not going to stand up behind and help the people that need it. That's the extent of my rant this morning.
We've spoken. Any questions? Okay. Can I ask one question?
Yes.
And it seems to me, as you mentioned, gambling is competitive. Even Washington State, La Santa area, 60 miles from Columbia River, they are going to have Washington's largest casino located in that area. Somehow our state has to compete in a defensive measure. What do you think of that? Do we just not do it, or do it, or compete it? Or what?
How do we compete? You know, I think I'd go back to the question that I asked is how do we want to raise revenues for the state? And I'm not sure that it's a matter of competing with other places for gambling dollars. If we truly want to fund education, we need to take a lot harder look at our tax code and loopholes to make sure that we're funding it through conventional sources rather than the gambling option. Let's go back. I mean, gambling started. Why did the state start it? It was to promote economic development. And through the last 10 years, we keep adding on. Well, let's use it for this and let's use it for that. Salmon habitat is a good cause, but it gets added on. Well, again, is that what it was all about? I mean, it just kind of evolves and takes a life of its own, just like adding these casinos on other properties.
Okay. Thank you very much. Representative Nelson?
Yes, thank you. Is it Gilbert?
Yes.
Mr. Gilbert, what percentage of your revenue for each of your two gambling establishments, what percent of your revenue comes from your gambling by your clients?
It's approximately, for my revenues, it's about 9% at each location.
Follow up, Mr.
Follow-up.
So what have you been able to do that others can't do? We heard testimony earlier that, in many of the retailers, restaurants or bars, they're unable to keep them aloft without the machines. So what is your secret, or do you mind sharing?
I don't know that I have a secret. It's part of a larger business that we have. It's a bowling center. In one
bowling?
Of them, yeah.
Oh.
One of them, it's a bowling center with a bar. And then the other one, I've got a sports bar. A sports bar. And then also with it, there's an entertainment center beyond that. In a pizza
like video
parlor.
Games for children and teenagers.
A pizza parlor, just kind of a recreational area as well that are kind of under that same roof. It works up to about 9%, and I think that some businesses for sure. I mean, in that 9% is a critical percent for me. I'll be honest with that. I don't. When you look at the one business I started about 3 years ago with my partner, and we evaluated and went to the bank, with all the numbers and our planning budget, counting on that. And like I said, a lot of businesses, that's how they've been sold. In 10 years, a lot of businesses have been bought and sold. But I also think that there's been another industry that's been created that's questionable.
So last follow-up, Mr. Chair.
Okay, last follow-up.
So therefore, if you have an agreement with the lottery and you sell your business, you sell the rights to those machines for how many of the 4 years you have left when you sell your business? Aren't they four-year contracts?
Well, the current one is a six-year contract. However, it's been said that the state can, has a complete option to terminate that six-year contract. and the state is a legally recognized monopoly, I'm sure they can. However, you know, in evaluating a business, you sit down and you look at your income, you know, from all the different pieces, your debt service, what your labor is, what your other costs of doing business are. So it's included in your income.
So you can, excuse me, lottery machines with your business?
No, that's all dependent on the lottery. Now, that when you sell the business, the other person applies to the lottery to become a retailer.
Oh.
Okay, it's not contingent that way. However, in the purchase of the business, you sit there and you say, look, here's what we've done the last 3 years. And so you're evaluating that, you know, those dollars that are coming in. So, and you can, I mean, that's what the bank wants, you know, when you're going to, you know, value it out and make sure you're going to be able to pay your debt.
All right. Thank you very much.
All right, thank you.
Before we go, I'd like to call just one more person, and Carol Bono. And if you could come up, I have a couple that the informational questions, if I may. Carol Bono from the Oregon Lottery. Welcome and thank you very much. Okay, and my question is, I'd like to know how much percent of the lottery proceed going to the advertisement at this time.
Chairman Lynn, for the record, my name is Carol Bono, Assistant Director for Marketing for the Oregon Lottery. For the last several years, we dedicate approximately $700,000 to education about the problem gambling issue and the treatment available. That includes television production and media. We do some radio production, although those spots are aired as public service announcements by radio stations. We print materials, posters, and brochures that our retailers are required to post that provide the helpline number. And we also help fund research through the Oregon Gambling Addiction Treatment Foundation, of which I am also a member of that board. And we set, that standard was set by Director Lyons in the late 90s to say that we should spend 10% of what we do on our game advertising on outreach for problem gambling treatment.
So actually you use the money out of the 1%. This is totally separate.
Chairman Lim, the 1% that goes to problem gambling treatment comes out of our profits, which we transfer to the state.
Okay.
That isn't under our control. That's set by legislative action. So the 1% comes out of our transfer rate. The $700,000 is part of our administrative costs that we, by statute, can spend up to 16%. Currently, we operate at under 3% of administrative costs,
okay,
but that comes as part of that expense.
So it's the $700,000 is for the in biennium, or is it for 1 year?
That's for an
annual
budget.
All right, and thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Any questions? We appreciate it. And we will close the public hearing at this time. And the meeting is adjourned until next Monday.